Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. This is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Although these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups that Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it'll ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of that if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're on the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, well, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the call over at this time to our speaker for this evening.
Michael Edward. Yeah, I'm back. Welcome back, Michael. Hey, look, ladies and gentlemen, we have been going through a course. We talked first about citizenship at length. Then we talked about our money system. And tonight we're going to talk about the Internal Revenue System or the service. Now, if you have missed those two calls and you would like to have an audio copy, archive of that call, simply reach out to me, preferably by email. And that way I can just hit reply, attach the recording to it, and send it back to you. You can also, if you go to www.AmericanByBirth. You can you'll see underneath the header two banners streaming from right to left, and you'll see there one of the banners says once we were colonists subject to a king, an essay on jurisdiction, and then the other banner underneath it says the greatest story never told, which is what I'm reading from. The greatest story never told was my introduction back in 2013, with a gentleman. He became an information provider before he passed away, and he taught us basically everything that's being and has been presented to you on the Monday night calls. He was an associate of GW's, unbeknownst to me, as well as myself, but I didn't know GW back then. And so these things that I'm sharing with you are important so that when you have corrected your political citizenship status, you'll understand at depth all that is at play. Unlike other people sharing this knowledge, you know, they basically give it to you and then say, oh, here's a loaded gun and go take care of it. That's the worst thing in the world. This all can be settled in courts. In fact, it is being settled in courts. And I encourage you to be on tomorrow night's call with Brother John as he brings you current with what's happening in different students' litigation that he is intensely training them to operate through, providing what they need as far as a teaching syllabus or material. On how to make a brief and things like that, that, well, sometimes the student even says, well, I like it just the way it is and I'm filing it, and they do. So, but they're just giving us teaching material. So tonight we're going to be chatting about the Internal Revenue Service, and give me 1 second. There we go. All right, so this topic is very technical and legal in nature. However, it is necessary to follow this legal maze that has been constructed as an obstacle to the American people who wish to understand the law and as it applies to them. And to understand the so-called law, well, actually, it's a code, so it's not law. You must first understand where and how the law is written. Federal laws being enforced today are actually statutes or codes. The body of these codes is found in the United States Code. Here and after, I'll be just saying the code, which is comprised of 50 different titles, each with a different subject matter. Congress supposedly wrote and approved the code, but it has not enacted all of the code into positive law, as you will soon learn. The part of the so-called law is found in the Code of Federal Regulations, and this is the body of rules and regulations written by bureaucrats who are supposed to implement this code. None of these rules and regulations were ever voted on by anyone, yet they're treated as law. In California Bankers Association versus Schultz, 39 L. Ed. 2nd, 820 and 830, the Supreme Court ruled that neither code nor regulations could stand alone as law. In that decision, the court ruled that the code was just simply broad language and that the penalties attached only upon the violation of the regulations thus prescribed. Therefore, in order for the force of law to exist, it takes both the code and the implementing regulations to give it power. Keeping this in mind, we will help you understand this evening the confusing facts which you are about to discover. Please try to make any prejudgments that you have as to what you believe and be prepared to set them aside as you listen to what I'm sharing with you. Do your best to hear with a clear mind, and you may see that the law does not say what you've always believed it said. In the end, you will see that the law means exactly what it actually says, regardless of what you may have thought it said. If you ask the people in America today what they fear the most, a large majority would just simply answer the IRS and kind of grab their stomach in the process because it's getting queasy just even bringing it up. If you ask who or what the IRS is, most will tell you that it's a branch of the United States government that collects taxes and that it is a government agency under the U.S. Treasury Department. After all, isn't that what we say that they are? That's what they say they are. Well, actually, no, it's not. If you examine their paperwork, even haphazardly, but if you look closely, you'll learn some interesting facts. To begin with, their symbol states, quote, Internal Revenue Service, Department of the Treasury, end quote. Seems clear on the surface. But a closer examination reveals an interesting fact. Nowhere does it mention the United States. It doesn't say Internal Revenue Service Department of the Treasury of the United States. It simply says Internal Revenue Service Department of Treasury. Don't all countries and most large companies have a Treasury Department? In fact, nowhere in any of the IRS's literature, its writings, its letterhead, or designation are the words United States or U.S. found in relation to the IRS. Well, certainly that could not be just an error, could it? So all we have to do is to go to the Department of the Treasury. There, the IRS will be found as an agency under the Department of the Government. Right? No, wrong again. Title 31 of the United States and Chapter 3 of the title devoted to Department of Treasury of the United States, Chapter 3, that title is the organizational breakdown. There are 10 agencies or offices within the department. just 10, and they're listed. Here they are. 1, Department of Treasury. 2, Treasury of the United States. 3, Bureau of Engraving and Printing. 4, Bureau of the Mint. 5, Federal Financing Bank. 6, Fiscal Service. 7, Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. 8, United States Customs Service. 9, Office of Thrift Supervision. And 10, Continuing in Office. That's it. I didn't see the IRS mentioned there, did you? Not a single word about the IRS. If you follow through the organizational breakdown of each of these agencies within the Department of the Treasury of the United States, you'll find that the IRS is not even a sub-agency under any of these agencies. So is the IRS so insignificant that it does not even get mentioned? Do you think you still believe it's just a mistake? If so, stick around, because there are a lot more mistakes that are going to be pointed out to you tonight. Several inconsistencies immediately appear if close study of the code and the regulations is undertaken. First, there's no act of Congress ever existing that created the Internal Revenue Service. There's no act of Congress that created the Internal Revenue Service. And if it were an agency in the government of the United States, one could easily find the act which created it. The fact is, there is no such act. And when questioned about this, the IRS simply says that that's a frivolous argument. Everyone knows they exist. Here we are. And they will refer you to their own manual, which has consistently been ruled to be inadmissible as evidence by the courts, and where it states, the Bureau of Internal Revenue has been organized under the act of last session. Also, it can be seen that Congress had intended to establish a Bureau of Internal Revenue, or at least they thought they had. This statement in their manual refers to the sessions of Congress of 1862, in which the Congress created an Office of the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. That same statement appears again in a similar publication in 1874 at 39 Federal Registry 11572. 174-1, Kumbel. The statement essentially admits that Congress never created, quote, Office of the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue, end quote. It clearly shows that the IRS itself cannot find anything whatsoever which actually created an agency called the Internal Revenue Service or the Bureau of Internal Revenue. The truth is, every government agency was created by some official document. And that document is easily found in the official register, in the official records. The Federal Register is the official record of everything that goes on in Congress. And every act that has ever been taken on by Congress is recorded there. The only time the Internal Revenue Service is ever mentioned in the Federal Registry is in 1976 at Federal Register Volume 41, dated September 15, 1976, where it states, quote, the term, quote, Director, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Division, end quote, has been replaced by the term Internal Revenue Service, end quote. So according to the Federal Register, Internal Revenue Service is only a term. It's a word. It's a phrase. It's not an agency. And Congress has never, ever, ever considered making it a part of the United States government. Why is that? Because constitutionally speaking, we have taxes. And those taxes are to be apportioned. If the federal government deems that there needs to be a tax that's equal to $1 billion, they'll divide $1 billion by 335 million people, or however many are of that or of the age of majority, and send them a bill. They have to pay it. That's the law. That's the Constitution. Plus, excise taxes, imposts, and tariffs. that our tax system is written in our Constitution. Are we to believe that something as powerful and all-encompassing as the IRS has its authority to operate so well hidden that even the directors of the agency itself cannot identify where that authority to act comes from? You'll find that this situation does not occur in any of the other agencies of the government, not one of them. All those that are listed as agencies of the government easily can be found their authority, but not for the IRS. In fact, a true government agency is required to state its specific authority to operate on request. So why would the IRS be any different? Moreover, if they truly had the authority that they claim they have, why wouldn't they just tell us, you know, where the authority arises from and be done with it? And authority cannot arise through their manual. The truth of the matter is the act which created that office of the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue, which was the only office or agency ever created that could possibly be deemed related to the Internal Revenue Service, was in 1862 and then was repealed by the enactment of the revised statutes of 1873. Get it? The IRS says that the office of the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue implied that Congress thought it had created a Bureau of Internal Revenue, and that the Treasury Decision 6038 changed that Bureau into the Internal Revenue Service in 1953. Well, if that were the case, why didn't Congress simply correct the error of not having properly created an agency with such expansive powers? And to do so would take very little effort on Congress's part, and would completely settle the issue. The whole idea put forth by the IRS as to its beginnings and its authority is patently false, because a Treasury decision would not only have the authority to create an agency in the United States government, it would not have the authority to create an agency in the United States government, and even if it did, the fact would have to be confirmed in writing somewhere at the congressional level, and therefore be found in the Federal Register. And it's not. Title 26 of the U.S. Code is also referred to as the Internal Revenue Code, which is the three letters IRC, Internal Revenue Code. This is a section of what is loosely referred to as the law that the IRS relies upon to enforce the tax laws. However, a close examination of Title 26 shows it has never been codified, nor has it been enacted or promulgated into positive law. Subtitle F of the Internal Revenue Code contains chapters 61 through 80 and sections 6001 through 7873 inclusive to it. And within these chapters and sections contained exclusively in Subtitle F are of the enforcement provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. Subtitle F of the Internal Revenue Code clearly takes effect and therefore gives authority only after the enactment and the promulgation of Title 26 of the United States Code into positive law. The day after, to be exact, the phrase, quote, shall take effect on the day after the date of enactment of this title, end quote, is used. It's actually phrased there within subtitle F in reference to when its provisions will take effect. The enactment of Title 26 has occurred as of this date. The enactment of Title 26 has occurred as of this date. The fact becomes clear in Section 7851. In the case of Title 26, 26 U.S.C. 7851A7, refers to the Internal Revenue Code of 1986. So this section is not an ancient writing which has no meaning today. The Internal Revenue Code of 1986 claims in Section 1 to have been enacted on October 22, 1986 as a part of the Tax Reform Act of 1986. Many of you who were paying taxes prior to 1986, probably thought it was enacted long before then, didn't you? The information is sparse. The information is convoluted. And for evidence of the fact that Title 26 has never been enacted, we only have to look at the preface of the 1988 edition of the United States Code, signed by and then the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Thomas Foley. In the second paragraph, it states, Titles 1, 3, 4, 5, 9, 10, 11, 13, 14, 17, 18, 23, 28, 31, 32, 35, 37, 38, 39, 44, 46, and 49 have been revised and codified. An enactment into positive law in the text, therefore, is legal evidence of the laws therein contained. The matter contained in the order titles of the code is prima facie evidence of the laws. By the way, prima facie means good on its face until challenged. It doesn't mean it's law. It just means that that's the appearance of law, and you have the right to challenge it. That's what prima facie means. In the same edition of the code under the heading Titles of the United States Code, all 50 titles of the codes are listed next to the title numbers that I just gave you. An asterisk appears. There's no asterisk at Title 26. At the bottom of the list appears the note. This title has been enacted as law. However, an appendix to this title has been enacted as laws. And here it is clear that Title 26 has not in effect, and since all enforcement is contained within Subtitle F, no penalties are available for failure to comply with Title 26 of the United States Code. Now, this maze begins to clear up as to what the IRS is and where it gets its power when we closely examine Section 7805 of the Internal Revenue Code. At 7805A, it states, except where authority is expressly given by this title to any person other than an officer or employee of the Treasury Department, the Secretary shall prescribe all needful rules and regulations for the enforcement of this title, including all the rules and regulations, as many as may be necessary by reason of any alteration of law in relation to the Internal Revenue, end quote. This is the section which gives the Secretary authority to write the needful rules and regulations for Title 26 of the Internal Revenue Code. This person, obviously, the same Secretary that is empowered through the Internal Revenue Code to carry out all the enforcement of this title. The code identifies this person as the Secretary of the Treasury, but it does not tell us which Treasury. Is he the Treasurer of Sears and Roebuck? He is the Secretary of what Treasury? To understand exactly who this person really is and where he derives his authority from, we must refer to the implementing regulations for this section written by this particular Secretary for a definition of exactly who he is. To do that, the government has printed what it calls the CFR Index, which is a cross-reference between the code and the regulations. The Code Federal Regulation Index lists as some of the implementing regulations for this section 27 CFR Parts 250 through 252. Under 27 CFR Section 250.11 definitions, the definition of secretary is given as, quote, the Secretary of the Treasury of Puerto Rico. Whoa, that's interesting. Anyone here from Puerto Rico? In Puerto Rico? This clearly refers to the secretary who is authorized by the Internal Revenue Code, Section 7805, to make the rules and regulations necessary to the enforcement of Title 26. This same secretary is necessarily the person referred to throughout the Internal Revenue Code who is given authority to perform the necessary tasks of assessing and collecting taxes. This secretary, obviously, is not an officer in the United States government, and there are His own words telling you that. What? Yeah, his own words are telling you that. How did that happen? All right. Remember the bankruptcy of the United States in 1933? Remember that? Anybody old enough? In that bankruptcy, banksters were the only recognized creditors. The Federal Reserve Bank was turned over to those banksters when the United States government admitted a verified debt to them. The right to print money and then loan it to the government was part of the turnover and proof of the debt. But the bankers were not content with this license to steal that was handed to them on a silver platter. Instead, they saw an opportunity to control everything, and by everything I mean including the people. Because the nation was in bankruptcy, still is actually, and the only form of currency available for use were instruments of debt, i.e. the Federal Reserve notes, anything bought with those notes became the property of the Federal Reserve Bank. Sounds crazy, right? But remember, a Federal Reserve note simply says that the holder of the note owes the Federal Reserve Bank the amount of money shown on the face of the note. Imagine for a moment that you loan me some money, that I signed a note to you saying I would repay the money at a future date. And let's say that I took out a note and traded it to someone who thought it had value for a car. Since the note only signified that I owed you money, who would own the true value received from it? If it were I, then have traded something with a negative value because I owed you money for something with a positive value, an asset like a car. In doing so, would that necessarily be committing fraud? Every time you use a Federal Reserve note to buy something, you trade something with a negative value. Again, remember, the Federal Reserve notes only record a debt to the United States, of the United States to the Federal Reserve Bank. That's all it does. And now you have it for something with a positive value that you purchased with it. The only party that can legally own whatever you purchased is the one who owned the value side of the Federal Reserve note. And who is that? It's the Federal Reserve Bank. Since we are operating in a bankrupt system, we are allowed to use the thing purchased as if we actually purchased it, owned it. But we can never have true ownership of it with the use of Federal Reserve notes. And we'll talk about that at a later time. Also, I just want to, on a side, mention that John has this awesome story. In fact, it happened a couple of times under John's watch, where someone who wanted to buy a car, who had the cash to buy the car, also had 21 silver dollars and also had a lot of gold coin. And he went to a friend of his whose actual gold it was, and offered to purchase the gold at the dealership so that the dealership, he got his gold back. The dealer got the full cash amount in Federal Reserve notes, but the actual transaction reflected this man purchasing this car for gold and silver. Constitutional ownership. That's what it showed. Interesting, isn't it? Give me a second here. Just one second. I clicked the wrong button and I lost my place. bear in mind. Okay. All right, so let me recap here. Let's say I took a note, traded it with someone who thought it had value for a car. We covered that because I owe, and that I owed you money. Who would own the true value I received from it? If it were I, then would trade it something with a negative value because I owed you the money for something which had a positive value of the car. In doing so, would necessarily have committed fraud. That was the question. Each time you use a Federal Reserve note to buy something, you trade something with a negative value for something with a positive value. The only party that can legally own what you ever purchase is who owned the value side of the Federal Reserve note, which is the Federal Reserve Bank. All right, so getting back to the secretary that we were talking about a moment ago and where the secretary gets their authority, it becomes clear that the ones who own everything, which is the bankers, have placed their own secretary in charge of looking out for their interests. Have you ever wondered why the Federal Reserve Bank has never been audited by the IRS? No other company of its stature can make that statement. Have you ever wondered how Alan Greenspan, who at one time was chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, can come into Congress and then dictate to Congress everything with regards to the rates, to what questions he will and will not answer? Congress never tells him what to do. Why? Simple. It's the Federal Reserve's bank, it's their money, it's their property, and it's their power, which this de facto government is ruling with and for. We're being ruled by the bankers. Naturally, their man is running the show. So where does the IRS fit into all this? It is, in fact, a branch of the Federal Reserve Bank. It is not a branch of the government. It is nothing more than a department within this huge corporation, which is operating under the assumption that it owns everything. And still don't believe that? Go back to the definition of secretary, which tells you that the secretary is the Secretary of Treasury of Puerto Rico. Remember that the Federal Reserve Bank is the only creditor of a bankrupt government, the United States. The United States was never given the power over the Treasury, which belongs to the Union States of America, the United States of America, the several states. The United States was never given the power over that treasury. It belongs to us, we the people. More specifically, the American people. The United States owns and rules the territories. And guess what? Puerto Rico is a territory. Therefore, it can cause the Treasury Department to do its bidding. And that is exactly what happened. The United States government followed the directions of its new lord and master, the banksters, simply wrote authority into the Puerto Rican Treasury Department and then convinced the American people that the authority arose from American laws. It didn't. And that's why Congress cannot enact Title 26, the Internal Revenue Code, into positive law. It just does not apply to Americans. By the way, Puerto Ricans are citizens of the United States, just like 14th Amendment citizens are citizens of the United States. But that does not make them Americans. Now, do you get the picture as to who is required to file and pay taxes? Does the term or title citizen of the United States take on any new significance to you now? Do you still want to be a citizen of the United States? Keep hanging on here, folks. The worst is yet to come. Most of you probably already heard the term voluntary compliance. When you heard it, chances are you thought, yeah, if I want to go to jail. Well, the truth is that we are under a system of voluntary compliance. That does not, however, mean that you can either choose to pay taxes or not. It's not that simple. What voluntary compliance means is that you can choose to participate in the system as a whole, or you can choose not to participate in the system as a whole. If you want to be a citizen of the United States, receive the benefits designed especially for those subjects of the government, well, you can obligate yourself by contract to abide by the rules of that system. Remember, in the 13th Amendment, involuntary servitude was what was made outlaw. It didn't say anything about voluntary servitude. Part of those rules say that you must pay a percentage of anything that you make under the system to the corporate head. To do so, it's required that you file a return under penalty of perjury, telling the corporation how much you owe. If you lie on that return, you're committing fraud. And you will be prosecuted under the applicable laws, not under the Internal Revenue Code. That's right. You will most likely be prosecuted under fraud laws contained in Title 18, not Title 26. And you guessed it. Title 18 has been enacted into positive law. On the side, it really hasn't. It's a sham and a scam. And we have the evidence to prove that Title 18 was never enacted into positive law. But that doesn't stop them from saying it is and all the judges agreeing with them at this point in time. In order to file that return, you must put down your slave number, that is your Social Security number, and then sign below it. This restates your wishes to remain in a contract for voluntary servitude to the Federal Reserve Bank. If you do not put your slave number down, your return is invalid, and the IRS will not accept any money from you. Why? Well, simple. You might be an American retaining full powers under the Constitution, and if you are, you do not owe any slave tribute to the master. You see, you are the master. The IRS has no jurisdiction over you, and it wants really no part of you. You're far too more powerful for anything, and that's the fact of government. So the idea is to keep you from knowing how you have this power, how much power you have, and what you can do with it, and it could be all yours if you simply claimed your birthright. But you say, what about the debt? What about the bankruptcy? Good question. But once again, we were duped. The American people never gave the authority to the United States to print fake money and throw the nation into bankruptcy. Therefore, the bankruptcy and the debt have no standing with Americans. It's just simple. It's just not our debt. That's how simple it is. Imagine you hire me to work on your car and authorize me to buy whatever parts on your credit card that are needed to fix the problem. But instead, I use your authority by going out and telling other people that I have your full authority to run all of your business affairs. And then I run up an unbelievable debt in your name, and I have no way to repay that debt. I may even go out and rob a convenience store just to try to pay the debt. It got so bad that your only recourse is bankruptcy. And would you be yelling this then if that debt was not your debt and you're not going to pay for it? Would you like to treat me like a king, or would you like me to be thrown into jail? I think the answer is obvious for that kind of fraud. Would you spend your entire wealth trying to pay the creditors, which I created? Or would you just tell the creditors, hey, buddy, tough luck. You should have made sure that my authority was there before granting that credit. Would you be willing to go to jail because I robbed the store to pay off your debt? I think we all know the answer to that question. But what the United States did was actually no different. Read the Constitution. If you're listening to me on this call, have you read the Constitution? Actually read it? Dissected it? Read the Constitution and find one place where it authorizes the United States to do things it did. Where does it authorize the stealing of true wealth through the printing of certificates with no worth? Where does it say that the American people turn over all their wealth to the United States for them to squander as they please? Where does it give the United States the right to put the American value and worth at risk in any form? Clearly, fraud, deceit, and outright theft has occurred in the United States government for many years. And it's getting worse. And that's because the Americans have been duped into believing that they are citizens of the United States. And as such, the United States, being all powerful Oz behind the curtain, is all powerful in their rights as they are concerned. Fortunately, this is a mistake which can be corrected by those who wish to regain control of their birthright. But we'll have also the same intestinal fortitude on your part if you want to do so. As for the IRS, it's a paper tiger. It has no power, and it has no power over you. But remember, it is a well-entrenched thought that you will have to be very certain of yourself to claim your freedom. It will do and say things which will scare the pants off you, the IRS. Don't underestimate them. It is a compromise of treacherous leeches who have lived off of your efforts for well over 50 years, closer to 100 years, and it will do anything to keep its power. If you understand the real issue, that is, the American national is the sovereign, you can easily defeat it. The jurisdictional issue rules over all else. I'll repeat. The jurisdictional issue rules over all else, even in the corrupt courts, which oversee the code of regulations today. None of the IRS agents will want to butt heads with an American national who knows that he is the fountainhead of the sovereignty of this nation. The true definition and the structure of the Internal Revenue Service is that one of a branch of a huge corporation. It's not the government. And whose sole purpose is to collect the agreed amount of tribute from persons who have contracted with the mother corporation to become subjects of that corporation and then to receive benefits and privileges from that corporation. Their power comes from a contract and is virtually absolute with regards to the persons in that contract with that corporation. You must never trust anyone who ever works for the Internal Revenue Service or alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, which is also, incidentally, the second branch of the Federal Reserve Bank. They're not just good people doing their jobs. They are the embodiment of all that is wrong in America today, and they are inherently evil. Look at Waco, Texas. There's a breakdown. The Americans, there is this to break down the Americans to the point where he has no longer even knows what his power is. And they're ignorant of these facts. The American people are ignorant. And that they are abandoned in their ignorance. If the IRS gets your trust, they'll use it against you. And if you do have friends that work with the IRS or the ATF, I'd encourage you to get new friends. So this concludes tonight's talk about the IRS. Next week, we're going to talk about what the United States actually is, and I guess we'll go from there. Let's see. Let's get ready for questions and answers. If you like, press star 2 on your keypad. Raise your hands, press star 2, and we can chat about that. Press star 2. While you're thinking about doing that, I'm going to go check Freedoms Radio to see if anybody's read the instructions over there and already written up a question. I want to remind everyone again that you go to AmericanByBirth.com and you can read what I've just been reading you. It's an entire book. I encourage you to print it out and to also print out in a separate little booklet to be bound once we were colonists subject to a king. If you like to be bought and paid for, owned, a franchise in the United States, if you're good with the system as it is, you don't need to consider correcting your political citizenship status. However, if you want to be a free man or free woman, if you want to have all of the law on your side, no matter what, I mean, the courts today can't even deal with an American national in their court. Once they get the idea, once they understand what's going on, which usually occurs when, and there's this court case. I love this court case. Let me see if I can find it real quick so you can hear this, because you need to hear this. Hold on. It's printed somewhere at the end of oncewewerecolonists.com. It says that, where are you? Come on. This is Frankenhauser versus Rizzo, 59, FRD. This is a 1973 court decision. I mean, it's very new. Quote, and this is what gets their attention. It is the manner of enforcement, which gives Title 42, 1983, its unique importance. For enforcement is placed in the hands of the people, not your prosecutors, not the lawyers. It's in the hands of the people. Each citizen acts as a private attorney general who takes on the mantle of the sovereign, guarding for all of us the individual liberties enunciated in the Constitution. End quote. I'm telling you, once you have corrected your political citizenship status, they can't deal with you. They're going to try, but they can't. And, of course, tune in tomorrow night and learn more about it. Now, how many times have you heard a police officer say, well, he thinks he's a sovereign citizen? Show them this court case. Frankenhauser versus Rizzo, 59, FRD. 1973. It says there, each citizen acts as a private attorney general who takes on the mantle of the sovereign. So if a citizen takes on the mantle of a sovereign in a twisted kind of way, doesn't that make him a sovereign citizen? Now, you have heard me say, and I'm saying it again right now, there's no such thing as a sovereign citizen. It's an American national who holds the sovereignty by birthright. Co-sovereignty, I should say. All right, so let's close this out and see if anybody's raised their hands. Bruce, how you doing there, Bruce, from Texas?
Good. I'm doing great. So I know the steps, so I'm not going to ask you to rehash them, steps to correcting your status. What are the basic steps to divorce yourself from the IRS after you've corrected your status, or does that take care of that?
No shortcuts. All right, so once you've corrected your political citizenship status, and really, Bruce, I'd like you to ask this question tomorrow night to John, because he's the answer man for that. But I'll just tell you this, that there's a series of letters that go back and forth between you and the IRS where you're constantly asking questions. And every time you ask a question, they give an answer or they don't give an answer, and you tell them your letter of such and such did not contain an answer that I could find. Would you please clearly state? Anyways, you keep narrowing it down to where you've taken them in from this really big room that they operate in, and you've got them now pushed finally into a corner. And, you know, it takes 6 months to 18 months to navigate this back and forth. But finally, the end result is
it's worth
getting a letter that says, we agree with you that you're not liable to file a tax return.
Would that be just for, same when I do it, just for me personally or for my companies also? Or?
Oh, no, just for you personally. Well, wait a minute. Now, your company is a different thing.
Okay.
Your company exists at the pleasure of the government. Your company, okay? So there is a way around that. And if you go to Justice Beshear's website, theultimateinassetprotection.com, go to that website. Underneath the header, that's the big thing with the pictures and stuff on it. On the underneath the header on the far right side, you'll see what looks like a golden horseshoe. click on the golden horseshoe. It'll take you to a page with 10 or 11, 12 PowerPoint presentations.
Okay.
Start at the first one and walk yourself slowly through all of them.
Okay.
When it gets to the part where it says you need...
ultimateinassetprotection.com.org.net.
.com. www.theultimateinassetprotection.com. Theultimateinassetprotection.com.
Right,
and
okay.
you'll see it there. And basically there's two different parts of your life you want to deal with. You want to deal with freeing your flesh. You want to be recognized from the point of your birth. That's why we don't say you're changing your political status. You're correcting it.
Correct.
If you were changing it, you were fine with what it was before, but now you want to become this, which doesn't work. You're correcting your political citizenship. That's one thing. The other thing is to put you into a position through ecclesiastical law.
Okay.
You see, there's many law venues, admiralty, bankruptcy,
right.
Chancery, common law, ecclesiastical, all these different venues of law. Ecclesiastical law can't be touched unless you commit crimes through it or commingle taxable money with non-taxable money under
gotcha.
That. That's the only two stipulations. So
okay.
by getting yourself to a place where you own nothing, control everything through the corporation soul,
right.
and then you yourself are become an American national, there is nothing that they can do to put their hands on you. And then if you use the golden horseshoe for commercial activity, you,
okay.
under the law, reporting everything step you're doing to the IRS. I did this, I did that. There's a place in that flow where the IRS loses its ability to collect.
Okay. It
drops off. So follow that and you're home free.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else? Press star 2. Brother Kirk, good to see you. We missed you last night on Justice Bashir's call. I had to fake you for your scuttlebutt. What's up?
So what you're looking to do with the IRS is to become, just like we did with the Bernie's Trust, is to become a non-taxpayer.
Correct.
So
correct.
Is that how they acknowledge it? Or do you have to ask them that?
No, you don't have to ask them anything. They're going to come after you. That's
okay.
All right. They're going to come after you. And there is a system of communications that over a period of 6 months to a year and a half, you'll end up having them say, we agree with you that you don't, we're not required to file your 1040s. Keep records. They're the ones that will say it. And again, John, be on the call tomorrow night. Ask him how this works. He'll be glad to share it with you.
Okay. I need to do some research here. So you say that it's America by Birth, American by Birth.
www.americanbybirth.com.
Okay. I got to take a look at that website.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Brother Kent. Oh, you're gonna tie me up, aren't you?
No, I'm not going to tie you up. I'm just going to ask you what I think is probably a relatively simple question for you to answer. For the average party out there or the average man or woman out there, what would you think the number of procedures would be that one would have to use to free themselves totally from the system? Like you just said, you know, correcting the status is not adequate, as you told Bruce. You know, he would go through some procedures with the IRS.
Wait a minute. correcting your political citizenship status ultimately boils down to one single page, which is a declaration in the form of an affidavit about your status. That's it. Now, there's a lot of mechanisms that are going on around it and where you send it and do this, that, and the other, but in essence, it's one page. And in truth, I was asked this the other day, Michael, what would happen if you hadn't corrected your political citizenship status and you know what you know? You're able to pull these court cases up out of your head. How would you have, what would you do in a court situation? You know, if you're charged with doing 100 miles an hour in a 70 mile an hour zone, 30 miles over the speed limit, a criminal traffic thing, how would you handle it? And I would challenge their assertion. Once somebody asserts a thing, Kent, you owe me money. I want my money. Your response is, do you have any evidence that I owe you money? What is your evidence that I owe you money? You don't deny any owing me money. You just ask me for my evidence. You may, in fact, owe me money. But where's my evidence? Because you happen to know the IOU note that I had was stolen from me, and I don't have it in my possession anymore. Why is it stolen from me? Because you paid some crook to break into my house and steal it from me. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now I don't have it. So your only question to me in the courtroom is, well, Michael, you say I owe you money. Where's your evidence? Okay. So if I go into court, I'm saying you're asserting that I am a United States citizen. Is that, where is your evidence that I am?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and of course, my affidavit's in there saying I'm an American national. Are you going to rebut that?
That wasn't really my question, though.
Beg your pardon.
My question. Okay. So that's a good explanation, and I appreciate your. I think what you're doing on Monday nights in lieu of Greg being present is actually very good. I think it's a good synopsis of how we got to where we are today. But having said that, my question is, have either you or Greg narrowed down the number of procedures necessary to be completely free of the system? So, in other words, in your answer to Bruce saying, oh, no, there's a series of letters that you would do over the course of 6 to 18 months with the IRS. Okay, so after we have the correction of the political status, then people who want to carry that further and not work off some presumption that, okay, now everything is corrected because everybody has been told, I told the State Department, well, now they're going to presumably go ahead and deal with the IRS. How many, now I realize everybody's life is different, but if you were to narrow this down for the average man or woman, how many different items would you have to cover to be completely free of the system? I've heard Bernie allude to this and say, well, you know, there's probably more you should do beyond correcting your status. But I never heard him go into, other than talking about the IRS, other agencies that you would want to deal with. I'll put agencies in quote, that you would want to deal with and accomplish the same thing so that you're going beyond just correcting your status at the State Department.
Right. Bernie has another program where, and he titles it the Peaceful Withdrawal. That's what it's called, peaceful withdrawal.
Okay, I never heard of it. Okay.
Yeah, and it's basically where you go back with certain places that had your signatures throughout your lifetime, where you rescind your signatures. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that he used to offer, but sadly there were people involved that had. Did not have the financial resources to live outside the system.
Okay.
And they had to get back into the system.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can only claim the bank's, the government's fraud one time. You can honestly say, I didn't know, and I'm rescinding my signature now that I do know. But if you go back in, you can't make that claim anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So post-RV, when I will be looking for other things to sell, pardon me, it's the nature of the beast. I like to sell. It's fun. We will be offering Justice Beshear's program in addition to correcting your political citizenship status, so that you get them in the crosshairs. You get them on both sides in a crossfire. And that just dots your I's and crosses your T's on that.
So are you talking about such things as vehicle registrations, driver's license, voter registration, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yep.
Okay. All right, so that's obviously going to vary by man or woman, depending on how old they are, how entrenched they are in the system, what
right.
they participated in, whether they ran a business, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right. But to answer your actual question, the answer is unknown. Why is the answer unknown? Because here in America, or the United States of America, or just the United States, anyone can sue anyone for any reason. As someone said once, I can get an indictment on a ham sandwich. Sure, you can do it. So there will be a time when most everyone will be under attack. And you're blessed to have what we refer to as the team. And the team is successful in dealing with these attacks.
Well, those attacks will probably minimize over time as more people
yes.
do this. Yeah.
Well, once grass fire communications gets out there and is populated in the millions, where the American people finally take back the reins of self-government, it's game. We will have our nation back once this has been released within two and a half election cycles, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's my prognosis.
Okay.
Anything else?
No, that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kent. Always great questions. Thank you. All right, next is someone ending, the phone number ending in 6090. May I say hello to you? I'm Michael.
Hey, Michael, can you hear me?
Perfectly clear.
No,
your name, please?
This is Tom from Spokane.
Oh! Yeah, you like it when I say Spokane, don't you?
Yeah, I love it. So this process, once it's started, is that retroactive? Will that go back to my birth?
Yes, because you're saying in the affidavit, you say, I want you to correct your records, nunc pro tunc.
So then I can ask for all the taxes that I've paid for my life, I can ask for them back?
Well, you can ask, sure. Are you willing to fight for it? You got the money to fight for it? Yeah, we'll fight with you. We'll help you.
Okay, that was my question.
And, Tom, I really would like you to ask that question again tomorrow night with Brother John.
Okay, yeah, I got on late tonight. I've been working, so.
It's all right.
What, it starts at 9?
9 o'clock Eastern, 6
yeah.
Pacific.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate you.
I appreciate you, Tom. Well, I'm glad you're calling in. Thank you, sir. All right. Anyone else? Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Press star 2. Let me check Freedom's Radio real quick while we wait for anybody else to raise their hands. And we have somebody here says, I'm on the website, American by Birth. Could you please repeat where do I find the book you're reading from? Sure. All right. So you've got this thing on all websites called a header. It's the very top, and it's usually got some pretty pictures or whatever that tells you where you're at. Underneath the header is what's called a navigational bar, which has tabs. You click on the different tabs, and it takes you to different places. American by Birth, I think there's only one line of tabs. So underneath that, you'll see two ribbons streaming from the right to the left, from the right side of your monitor to the left side of your monitor. The one on the top should say, once we were colonists, subject to a king. a primer on jurisdiction. And then the band underneath it says, the greatest story never told. So the greatest story never told is what I'm reading from. I hope that helps you. Again, let's see if we have anybody up front. Press star 2 on your keypad. Bum, 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 bum. Well, I guess that's going to be it. So I want to remind everyone, tomorrow night, Brother John will be returning as of 4 hours ago when I last spoke with him. He should said he'll be here.
We have one more. We have one more that just raised their hand. Let me unmute. Stand by. Refresh. My machine is slow. See if this opens. Brad, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, welcome. Good deal. We have Brad from one of the most beautiful cities, actually, in the entire state we call Florida. It's gorgeous. I had an argument with myself for quite a while as to where I wanted to be. It's just the Gulf Coast has never been warm water like the Atlantic is that I'm accustomed to with the Gulf Stream. And that's why I stayed over here. Anyways, Brad, what's your question?
I'm actually Ocala.
Okay. I have Crystal River on your caller
ID.
Well,
yeah, that's my... we have like a family deal with the cell company, and they are over there, but I'm not. Yeah, I'm actually in Ocala. So, you know, we tried to do a transaction today, and it was...
Let's keep that private, please.
We'll keep it private, but there was something said with the first caller that I want to clear up, and that is that, you know, everything that I make money-wise is coming from an LLC, and I want to make sure that you guys are completely aware of that.
Okay.
And does that make any difference as far as what we will be doing education-wise?
No, because the IRS views an LLC as a pass-through. They don't look at the money that the LLC makes. They view that quote income end quote as what the responsibility is of the manager. Number one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you're the manager of this LLC, then the manager is the one that's saddled with the alleged tax debt. Now, if you're not aware of this, I encourage you to be on the Wednesday night call. Now or then, sometime in the future, you may want to strongly consider rearranging your organization to a limited liability company that actually has no tax liability associated with it. You actually can do commerce through this specific LLC. And the reason that you can is because the originations of this LLC come from people who have never had a Social Security number assigned to them. In other words, 25, 30 years ago, mom and dad fully had heads up on what was going on. And when little Johnny was born, it was like a home birth. Nothing to do with getting Social Security numbers assigned at birth or anything like that whatsoever. So little Johnny is the fountainhead of this LLC that's created. And then by means of an internal transfer of management from little Johnny to Brad, you just keep on running with it. Now, the thing that we've added to that, there was a little roller coaster that we were going through when, this is 2025, so January of 2024, a law came into effect on January 1st, 2024, that the Know Your Customer thing had to be filled out for every LLC, no exceptions. And then once that LL, once the Know Your Customer was filled out, then they were facing tax consequences that they would not have otherwise been facing. So there, we went through the list of exceptions under this law that was passed to become effective January 1st, 2024. And exception number 19 was that if the management were non-taxpayers, well, limited charitable religious trust that Justice Beshear populates is a non-taxpayer. So what we did is we added to this LLC two CRTs, charitable religious trusts, as the managers, of joint managers of the LLC, and there's a reason why we do that as well. And then you're the trustee to these CRTs. So you have total complete control, and then the way this is organized and set up, it didn't have a tax responsibility to begin with. Then it had the demand to identify who the managers were, and then the circumvention to that was to create two CRTs as the managers, and you just hid behind them, if you would, or operated behind them. And then I think it was June of last year that the Supreme Court said that it was that rule, that law, Know Your Customer, could not apply to the LLCs. So it was a moot point after that. However,
well, I don't want you to waste a lot of breath here or feel like you waste a lot of breath here. You're not. I'm listening.
No.
Actually,
I'm selling. I'm selling, Brad.
Yeah. I have one of those LLCs.
Okay. You're in high cotton.
Yeah, and I operated under that for about 6 months. And eventually, I couldn't really afford it anymore. And then, you know, Mr. Slevin had issues with the bank he was dealing with. And that was major issues. And I've been talking to Mr. Slevin, like, I really want to operate, you know, under that LLC. But it didn't take into account certain characteristics of, you know, the retail business. And the main thing was that I need change, like a constant supply of change, you know, pennies, nickels, quarters, things like that, and bills. Uh-huh. And when I was with the bank that he was originally with, I didn't know it. They never told me. I didn't read, you know, any of the stuff, which would have. But I was getting bills at the end of the month that were way more than any of the change that I had asked for. And it was just, it was a disaster to go with that. So now, if I go with that company, if I try to use that like an umbrella company over what I'm doing, yeah, there's all kinds of problems because I can't just supply my retail business with change easily. And
sure.
So I've been talking to him with, you know, how can we make peace with that situation and move forward. But mostly because of the business that you and I are doing right now, I just wanted to make sure that you guys understand that that is my source of money right now. So
understood.
So anyway, that's it.
Okay.
But,
just wanted to make sure that we had that covered.
If you have any more,
you're fine.
I'd like to hear it, but. No, I actually have an LLC with him, and I would love to use it. I think about that every day. I would love to use it.
Yeah, when was the last time you talked to his Herr Slevin?
Probably been 3 or 4 weeks now.
3 or 4 weeks, okay. Well, no hurry, but sometime in the next 3 or 4 weeks, we should have a four-way conversation. You, myself, Mr. Slevin, five-way, and Brother John to, map all this out.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, for myself, I have, I think, three LLCs through Mr. Slevin.
Mm-hmm.
And I have stepped away as being the manager and am in the process actually right now of having two CRTs be the managers on official managers of the LLC. Anyways, we'll talk in the next couple 3 weeks on that with Mr. Slevin and John, okay?
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Anyone else, press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. I'll be happy to answer some questions here. Let me check Freedom's Radio. While I'm checking, I just want to remind everybody that tomorrow night we are anticipating Brother John on the call. It will be a live call as of this moment. He is having surgery in the morning, but it's very light surgery compared to what he's gone through before. And so we're not expecting any kind of problems with it and for him to be here. We will be talking about the ownership and the movement of land from property, from real estate to actual land, and how to do that by virtue of a warranty deed and fee simple to begin with, and then how to springboard from there into holding the land in allodial title. So that's tomorrow night. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.